Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. As has been said, this show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself with others. Now today I have on a special guest who's a member of my church. Her name is Vanessa Johnson, and she's a professional storyteller who will tell some compelling tales of her journeys of days gone by. She'll transport you to another time and place with her vivid storytelling, and we're going to talk about our own spiritual journeys, as I always do with my guests, or attempt to do, is talk about what has led them into a place of hope. And in Vanessa's case, it sounds like she's always been in that place, which is a wonderful place to be. And so perhaps she will inspire other people who have lost hope or who can't see the light at the end of the dark tunnel. Let me assure you that for every long dark tunnel, there's always a light. For every dark cloud, there's always a silver lining. And when you can embrace the totality of your life as good, even the seeming bad, you will realize that everything has happened for a reason, which has brought you to your today and can bring you to a better tomorrow. And so with that said, I'd like to introduce Vanessa. Vanessa, once again, how are you doing tonight?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I lost you for a minute there. What happened?
Oh, I don't know, but I got us reconnected.
That's all that matters. That's all that matters. Well, thank you for joining us tonight. As I may or may not have told you, most of the people that listen to the show listen to the archives. They hear the show in recorded form in a podcast. And there's the possibility that we may have some callers who would be interested in speaking to you. And so I just wanted to let you know that and see if you're open to that, if we do have that situation.
Oh, sure. I welcome. Conversation is wonderful. It's good to talk with each other.
Absolutely. Well, I've asked Vanessa to tell us an inspirational tale, and I'm going to let her take it away. She's the storyteller. I'm just the radio show host, amongst other hats I wear. So, Vanessa, I turn it over to you.
Okay. Connected to my life is I have a nonprofit organization called Syracuse Africa Bound. And I work with other people in the community to take kids from Onondaga County in upstate New York to Ghana, Africa. And this program I started in 1989. At the time, I owned an African-American art gallery and bookstore. And I saw this kid acting out, this young kid acting out on the street, being disrespectful to some adults, and I went outside and I grabbed him by the arm and pulled him into my gallery. and had a talk with him about his behavior. And I told him, not on my street. You're not going to be disrespecting adults where I can see you. And we got to talking, and I said to him, look, I will give you a little part-time job after school. Let's talk to your mother, see if she agrees, but it has a stipulation. I have to be able to call the school each day and find out if you were in school. And if you were in school, you can work. And if you weren't in school, you couldn't. And you have to bring your homework and do your homework first. So we walked over to his housing complex, talked with his mom, and came up with this plan. So every day he would come to my store and he would do his homework. And then I, you know, let him sweep or, you know, help with picture framing or something. We would talk, and I would give him some money at the end of each day. And one day he came in with, he was angry. And we talked about why he was angry. He was angry because his teacher, who happened to be white, did a little lesson on Africa. And he said, made the Africans look like they were stupid and like they were monkeys living in trees, were his own words. And we talked about what Africa was really like. I went and got some books and we talked about it and talked about African history. And I said to him, the best way to know anything is to see it yourself, to go see what Africa was. And he said to me that, I said, you need to go and visit Africa one day. And he said to me something that really shocked me. I grew up in a family where we were taught that no matter what the obstacles were, that you could do anything you wanted to do. It may take a long time. You may have to find a different way to do it. You might have to be creative. You might, but you could do anything you wanted to do. And he said to me, I am poor. I will never go to Africa. And I was shocked to have a 8-year-old child tell me this. He was between eight and 10, I believe. And before I could think about it, I said to him, oh, then I will take you. And I almost put my hand over my mouth after I said it. I was so surprised that those words came out of my mouth. But one of the things with kids, for me, is that if you promise them something, you do it. And so having made that promise, having said those words to him, I knew I was stuck with those words that I had to take him to Africa. And so that night I went home and I called all of my friends and I said, guess what we're doing next summer? We're taking kids to Africa. And I have amazing friends and some of them who are just as crazy as I am, and we see the world in possibilities and not as things that we can't do. And we started Syracuse Africa Bound. And so we started taking kids to Africa. In 2006, we had a young lady who wanted to come. Her mother wanted to come with her. And I said to her, you know, I'm sorry, 2005. And we raised money together to go, and her mother was involved. But her mother let me know in the very beginning that she was sick with cancer, and she was struggling. And we signed up kids in April, the summer before we go. So April of 2004, we had signed up kids for 2005, worked to raise the money. And around December, her mother called me and said, I don't think that I will make it. And her cancer was killing her. It wasn't in remission. It wasn't responding to treatment. She says, will you promise me that my daughter will be on that plane? And I said, if I have to pay for it myself, I will do that. I will make sure she's on the plane. And her mother did pass away. And it wasn't me. It was her mother's Job P Plus in Syracuse, New York. The employees raised the money through sales and fundraisers, and they raised the money for this child to go to Africa. And I can remember one night we were traveling late at night. back to a small fishing village that we were staying at. And I looked over at the child, and I saw she was really sad. I knew she was thinking about her mom. And I said, "You miss your mom, don't you?" And she said, "Yes, yes, I do. She should be here." And I said, "You know, your mom called me in December to let me know that she might not be able to get on the plane with us." I said, "But you know that she's here." And Amanda said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "She's right with us. Didn't you feel her flying beside the plane all the way here?" I said, "Don't you feel her spirit right outside the window of this van that we're traveling at?" And the whole trip, she says, "Maybe she is here." And the whole trip, I felt her mother's presence. I mean, when we went to the restaurant and Amanda refused to order Ghanaian food, we were in Ghana, and she complained about the chicken Alfredo, that it didn't taste right. And I said that, "Well, this is food that's made in Ghana. It is their version." "Oh, this is nasty," she said loudly in the restaurant. I said, "Don't say that so loud. You will hurt feelings, people's feelings." "Oh, it is nasty," she said louder, you know, as teenagers will act. And I heard her mother shush her and say, "You know, in our family, we eat what is on our plate. You eat that food." And I remember, like, the next morning, we were going to the W.E.B. Du Bois Museum in Accra, Ghana. He was an expatriate who left the United States because of the racism here and became one of the great Pan-African villages, leaders of the world. She came out of the hotel room with this little skimpy halter top. And I said, "Where do you think you're going? You know, we've talked about how dress speaks a lot here for who you are. You're not wearing that out with me. Go back in the hotel room and cover yourself." And she said to me significantly, "You're not my mother." But I heard her mother slap her upside the head and say, "You know I don't let you dress like that. You go back in that hotel room and you change those clothes, girl." And I can remember when we were in a small wood carving village and Amanda refused to get out the van. "I'm not interested in what's going on there." I heard her mother say, "Get off this van, girl. You go out there and you experience all of Africa." Her mother was there every step of the way because I know the high standard that she raised this girl at and how this teenager was testing those limits. But Mama was not having it. Her spirit was there making her do the right thing. Because when we left that carving village, Amanda said to me, "You know, Miss Vanessa, it is the things that you have made me do that I have learned the most from." Because we had to beg her to get on the van. We have to leave this village. And when we were at the orphanage and Amanda took around the whole time we were there this little boy and put him on swings and talked with him and held him and carried him, the whole time we were there, she came up to me at the end with the tears in her eyes when we had to leave and said, "You know, I turned 16 this summer. I get my first job. I'm going to talk to my other friends who are turning 16. We're going to pay this little boy school fees so he can go to school, like Jobs Plus paid for me to be here." Oh, yeah, I saw her mom, the spirit of her mom, just smiling. Oh, yeah, that's my daughter. And when we were out, way out in the bush, we're in this little village called Rara in the eastern region of Ghana. We were there to visit a library that Lemoyne College students had helped build and this family had built for their village. And she was like, "Oh, I can't stay here because the house we were staying at wasn't finished. The toilet, you had to pour water in for buckets, you had to take bucket baths, and there were spiders in the corners of some of the walls. Oh, I don't even camp. I can't stay here. You've got to get a helicopter to take me out of here." And how I was like, "A helicopter is not coming for you, Amanda." And she just went on and on and on. I heard her mother say, "Go to bed, Amanda. Find in yourself the person, the giant inside yourself, the warrior who can make it through this weekend in unfamiliar setting. Find something about yourself that you didn't know, some strength that you didn't know." And Amanda found it. So I traveled in 2005 with three wonderful kids that trip, and two moms that came with us, and a reporter from the Syracuse newspaper. We had a Vista volunteer. We had quite the entourage. But the person I remember the most from that trip was Amanda and her spirit mom that was with us every step of the way. And so that's my story.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much. That was very moving, and it sounds like you're very connected to spirit, and I'm wondering if that's been your experience for some time in your life.
Well, all my life, I was raised, I went to Bethany Baptist Church, one of the oldest Baptist churches here in Syracuse, New York. We were in church every Sunday with my parents, believers in Christianity and believers in church. And church was something that when I became a teenager, it was optional. We moved from the inner city south side of Syracuse, predominantly black neighborhood, but it was also black and white at that time. I'm 57, so this was in the late 50s and early 60s. When we were going to Bethany Baptist, we moved when I was in fourth grade, the beginning of fourth grade, to Camillus, New York, an all-white suburb. There was another black family in my elementary school, for example, but they moved a couple months after we moved there. And it was tough. This was a time of strong segregation across our land. And, the end of the civil rights movement, the North was going through busing and integration issues. And we were at a school where people didn't want us to be there. And I went to a church called West Genesee Hills Baptist Church, where Reverend Tompkins was the pastor then. And I remember we would go to church. My father would take me to church there because I wanted to go to church in my community and where I had friends primarily. And people would get up and move out of the pews away from us because we were black. That kind of thing. Oh, yeah. It was, so you had this Christianity sitting alongside extreme racism. It was a difficult school. It was a school where, I was spit on, pins stuck on me. I stopped taking the bus because I would be tripped and actual pins stuck into my body and that kind of stuff. So I would miss the bus every morning, this fight with my mother about missing the bus so that I could walk. And I would time it so that I would walk where no buses would pass me because they would spit out the buses and call you the N-word and all that. And no protection from teachers. I would tell teachers what happened, and they would say, well, what did you do? As if there was anything I could do that I deserved to be treated like that or be called the N-word. I was black. That was what I did. And I came to a school that was white, except for at that point my brother and my sister. My brother, because my sister was in kindergarten at another school. So it was a difficult journey, and church was no different. It was not a safe haven. And I can remember Martin Luther King. I went there several years with, my friends were there, and Martin Luther King died, was assassinated. And I think maybe the second year I was there, into the first year I was there, he was assassinated. And I would get let out my choice on Friday during the recess hour. A bus would come in. You could go to the Catholic school or you could go to this Baptist church for religious education. So I would go every Friday. And when King was assassinated, I asked at the end of the program, the teaching sessions, the minister would ask if we had anyone we wanted to have prayed for. And I asked him to pray for Dr. King's wife and his children. And he left them out of the prayers. And so my mother called him and invited him to our home. And he came one Sunday. My mother wasn't going to the church. My father was taking me there, or he was dropping me off. My sister had stopped going to the church. She was younger than I. And she had made a choice to go, I think it was Fairmount Community Church at that point, an interdenominational church. And I think my brother was still with me at the Baptist church. My parents let us choose you know, our religious journey as long as we are in church somewhere. And so she invited him to the house, and she asked him why he had not prayed for Dr. King's family and his wife. And he said that Jesus Christ had come into the world to teach people to live in a station of life, and that Dr. King would go to hell because he was teaching Negro people to live outside of the station.
Oh, my God.
I remember my mother kicked him out of our house, and I never went to that church again. I went to Fairmount Community Church, which was interdenominational. It was more, people were more loving and open. There were people from many walks of life and different religions who left that religion and or that part of the Protestant faith, and that they preferred being in an interdenominational church, a more open church. So, you know, at any point I could have turned away from God, church, everything, because certainly those situations would have compelled that. But where I found strength, not only from my family, my mother and father being very, you know, we would talk about everything, talk about what happened in school, you know, and my parents always gave us a strong center of self, that it is not you, it is them. It is not, you're not unworthy. It is them questioning their own worthiness is why they have to put other people down. You know, those kind of messages. But it was also, you know, the spirit-based family, spiritual-based family that believed in God and the parents who let us explore our religious beliefs fully. So that was kind of my rock in getting through, you know, that and other difficulties in life. My mother always said you can cry and whine and moan, but after you finish, what is there, what has happened is still there, and you have to deal with it. And that's something I've always remembered her saying that to me when I was very young, and saying to me that life was this corridor of doors, and that all doors were open to you. All you had to do is go and turn the handle, and that all possibilities were there. And there were doors that you wanted to pass by, like drugs, or, you know, getting pregnant as a teenager, or, you know, murdering somebody, or, you know, there were things you didn't want to do in life. And so you made choices, and there were doors you didn't go through, but that you also needed to be brave, and that doors of opportunity were just there for you to step through. And if you didn't, if you weren't brave and stepped through them, then you would regret it. And maybe you try to go back down the hallway and open that door, but that opportunity, it would be locked. That opportunity would no longer be there. So these were the kind of messages that I grew up with, and grew up in a household that believed in morality, that you thought outside of yourself. You know, I had the example of a father who had a upholstery business, and which would mirror what I did with that young boy. When he passed away, there were many people that came to the mic in his funeral, many African American boys who said that when they were a boy, my father was their other father, or he was their father if there was no father in the household, that they would have been in jail or dead or on drugs in the street, in a gang, if it hadn't been for his interventions. And what he did to them, with them, because my idea with this young man for Africa Bound wasn't new, it was from my father's example. He said, "You can work for me, but you must be in school that day." And he would call and check, and he would he would pay them at the end of the week, and they would have to have their homework done before they started work. And he not only did those things that I did with that boy, he took it a step further. He matched, when they got their first check, he took them to the bank and opened a savings account. And at the end of the year, he would match what they had saved in their savings account. And many of them, he walked girls down the aisle as their father, because they had no other father, but they had worked for him. He was there. He drove kids, to young men and young women, to school, to college. He was the one that went on those visits and stuff with them often. So he was like a father to many other kids who parents came to him and said, look, my boy's going to be in a gang. He's going to be in trouble. Give him some work. Please hire my son. Please hire my daughter. And so I grew up, you know, a mother who believed in the equal rights of all people, who didn't tolerate us making fun of anybody, saw everybody as valuable and equal, and who insisted on us volunteering. Every summer, I volunteered somewhere. I volunteered at MLK school doing tutoring. I volunteered for the Head Start program for 3 years. I used to go up and play guitar with a friend of mine at Plaza Nursing Home, a friend of mine who worked there, and I would go with her on Saturdays and play guitar. I would go in, and many of the people on the floor were Irish, so I was the little black girl that would come with her guitar and sing Danny Boy, and When Irish Eyes Were Smiling, all these Irish ballads for them. But my mother believed in social responsibility. We are not islands. We are responsible for the other people around us. And so a large part of that belief is from her and insisting on volunteering so that we knew what it was, what somewhat other people's lives were like, that we had privileges that other people didn't have. We had opportunities that other people didn't have. We had a family that other people, other kids did not have. And so
you had a lot of amazing grace in your life. You were blessed with a wonderful set of parents who instilled some wonderful values within you. And I heard you speak to the fact that you maintained a sense of self throughout all of those awful things that happened to you as a child. I'm wondering, backing up, how you perceived those people who would cast their judgments against you and do nasty things to you and call you the N-word. How did you react at that time, and what did you do with any resentments that you might have formed?
Well, I feel really blessed that I can't say that I don't have any resentments, because you remember, you know, you forgive,
right,
but you don't forget. But many of those kids who called me names became friends. I'm not sure. Like I said, I can only say it's from my parents' upbringing. I didn't hate them. I would always hear from my mother quotes by Dr. Martin Luther King about not letting, you know, people drag you so low as to hate them because of what they did. My parents believed in nonviolent, peaceful, nonviolent resolutions to conflicts. We were raised in a house that talked about Africa all the time, that talked about black history. So I had a strong identity to who I was, and talked about the tenets of Dr. Martin Luther King, quite honestly. And so I didn't hate them. My mother would give explanations as to why these white people acted like this, about people's own insecurities who are the people that behave like that, and try to make us understand why people hate each other. What are the things that make people hate each other? And so we weren't allowed, just frankly, allowed to hate them. I wasn't taught to hate. And so, and I remember years later, you know, like when I got in high school, and you're in dating time, you know, and some of the young white men asking me out, and I would look, you don't forget, and I would just look at them and say, you used to call me the N-word in elementary school. No, I didn't. Yeah, you did. So, no, I can't go out with you. I mean, we could be friends, but we can't. And I got one of them saying, "You think you're better than I am because I'm black? Because you're black." I was like, "What?"
Oh, there's self-esteem speaking up. There you go. That's good for you. I grew up in the suburbs too, and you know, the flip side of the coin. I did not. I grew up in a family that taught tolerance, and my mother had been raised during the Depression by a black woman by the name of Carrie Jones. And Carrie became like a grandmother to me. and she sat in the front row with my grandmother at my mother's wedding because my grandmother honored her and revered her. So I didn't think anything about the difference of the color of people's skin, and there were no black people in my community until I was in high school, and then there were three black children in high school, and I didn't really have a chance to become friends with them, but one of them went to my church, and I never knew about it at the time, but her family suffered similar things to what you're talking about at around the same point in time. Mm. It would have been probably the early 70s. And, I just find it very difficult to believe that that existed then, and of course, oh, so much worse going backward in time. And you so impressed me when we went on that tour to the Harriet Tubman house, and we went to the, I don't remember the name of the museum in Syracuse, where you did some narration.
The Historical Association, great museum.
Yes, you did some marvelous narration. I wonder if later in the show you'd be willing to tell one of the stories that you told then. Would that be putting you on the spot?
Oh, no, most definitely. This is what I do. And the nice thing about being a storyteller, you're and I call myself a griot, a G-R-I-O-T, and that's a storyteller in the West African tradition where you tell stories. You learn the stories of the people around you, of your region that you storytell in, and you visit villages and stuff, and you tell these stories again and again, and people know the stories that you're telling, and there's a call and response to those stories. So I call myself a griot, but most certainly I'd be happy to tell another story.
Thank you. Now, I'm curious, how did you learn these stories? Was there an oral tradition you picked up on?
Yeah,
or where
did
you?
Yeah, there was a oral tradition in my family. And with my father, you know, my parents were from the South. My father was from Deep South, Alabama. When I talk about Deep South, what I mean, KKK, lynchings, the whole thing. He was from Notasoga, Alabama, outside of a town called Tuskegee, where Booker T. Washington began the first black college in America. And my mother was from Houston, Texas. And a lot of people forget that Texas seceded from the Union. It's a Confederate state. You know, it was a Confederate state. And it was segregated. And so my parents migrated in the 60s, like many, early 60s, like many African Americans did to northern cities. That's how they ended up in Syracuse, New York, after graduating from college. They met in college. And so my family was far away, and we didn't have money all the time to, you know, go and see family. So they were voices on the phone, and they were the stories that my parents told about them. Now, my father was the big storyteller in my family. Oh, he could and he could take you on journeys with words and to other places into unreality. So sometimes you would have to say, oh, Dad, is that a real story? You know, one of the stories that was told at his funeral was one my father always, my father came from that generation that tries to out-poor, we say, because your po is poor, but you're too poor to afford all the letters of the words. So he would try to out-po other folks. My father wasn't quite as poor as he made out to be all of his life, but he was at one point raised in a dirt floor shack where you could practically see through the walls. There were so many cracks in the walls. So poverty, his father finally got a job in a white school. They lived in a structure in the back of the school, and it was a white school that he could not send his own children to. So my father was raised in that Deep South segregation. My mother was from a middle class family. Her mother was a teacher. My grandmother was a teacher. Her father had a job in a box factory. So they were, you know, they were decent. And at that time, my grandmother being for the black community, my mother, grandmother being a teacher was like, you know, being a doctor or lawyer in the white community. So she came from a very different background than my father came, but both of them had lived in segregation. Mm. So I would hear these stories, and I would hear family stories, because this is how they kept us in touch with family that we didn't see, grandparents and aunts and uncles that we rarely saw. But they lived all the time in my household through these stories. So, like, at my father's funeral, people were, you know, we had a microphone in the front, and people would come up and tell stories that Daddy had told them. And the minister told one that where my father said, I was that his father would put him out in the field behind a plow, like I was a mule, like I was a mule. I wasn't no mule. I didn't mean to be behind no plow. I knew God had something bigger planned for me, and I just hated how he put me behind that plow to plow that field. But one day the sky was just blue, and I looked up in the sky, and these clouds started forming, and they formed letters in the sky. A big G and P appeared. G, P, G, P. And I knew it was a message from God. God was telling me, go preach, go preach. G, P, go preach. God wanted me to be a preacher. He didn't want me behind no plow. I wasn't no animal. So I threw that plow down in that field, and I ran to the house. And I said, Daddy, Daddy, I've gotten a message from God. To big, look, look, you see them in the sky, the letters GB. He wants me to be a preacher. Go preach, go preach. And my daddy to me, he said, John, get yourself back out in that field. That means go plow, go plow. GB. So I was raised on these stories. My father never plowed, but he was all, that was part of outpouring, you know, outpouring folks, being poorer than the other people he was talking to. So he always had these stories, and these stories of growing up, and I would listen to him, but stories about black men being drug out of his community and lynched when he was a child, stories about the Ku Klux Klan, you know, were mixed in these other crazy stories. My mother, I think the story that I remember the most is the story was when she was a child, and she said that her grandmother was taking them shopping, took her shopping with her. And my grandmother had to buy, she was buying a hat and a dress and shoes and gloves, the whole getup that church ladies go to, in the black community go to church in. And they went to this nice department store in downtown Houston, and she shopped, and she wanted to try the clothes on. And the salesperson walked her back to what was obviously a storeroom. And she turned, my grandmother turned to the storeroom, the clerk, and said, why have you taken us to a storeroom? And the clerk said, now don't you cause no problems up in here, girl. And my grandmother said, go get the manager of the store. I want to talk to the manager. And the salesperson humphed, and she left the storeroom. And my mother said that my grandmother stood there holding her hand, stood erect like a proper Southern woman, holding the clothes in one hand, holding my mother's hand in the other. And about an hour later, they waited a long time, an hour later, here comes the manager of the store. Girl, what do you want? Don't be in here causing no trouble. And my grandmother said, this is a fine department store. I know you have nice dressing rooms. You aren't allowed to use these dressing rooms, and you know it. Why are you giving a problem here? And my grandmother said, I have been taken to a storeroom to try on clothes. My money is the same color as anybody's money here. And she dropped the clothes on the floor. And she says, I'm going to tell all the teachers that I know not to shop here anymore. I'm going to tell the black teachers I know and the white teachers that are my friends who will not shop here knowing that you have treated me this way. And my mother said that she walked out of that storeroom past that manager with her head held high, her hand in her mother's hand. And this is how it was, through stories that I got to know my family. And I got to know history, their lives in the context of history, their lives as African Americans in living in this country. And through those lessons, I learned who I was. I knew that what I endured at that school, for example, was small compared to what my parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had been through. So it was those stories that informed me of life, the stories that told me what was right and wrong, the stories that told me what was moral and what was immoral, that told me how people wanted to be treated and how people should be treated. And so I grew up with all of those stories. I ended up going into, you know, social work. I wanted to be, from sixth grade on, after being 2 years in the all-white school, I wanted to be a lawyer. I was going to be Thurgood Marshall. I was going to be the female Thurgood girl, Thurgood Marshall, and argue civil rights cases for people in front of the Supreme Court. And I went to college and got off track. I didn't know what I wanted to do anymore. I became jaded in internships and stuff with the legal system and the inequality that I saw there. Now if I could redo it, I would be a law professor, because it was the idea of how law equalized things, or had the potential to equalize things for people. But in the practice, I realized in college that that was not how law was being used, and certainly not how it was used against my people. So I kind of wandered with what I was going to do and ended up in social work, and worked for 10 years at Southwest Community Center in the Black community. Worked before that 4 years with runaways. I've worked with adjudicated kids. I've worked with kids for 4 years with kids in a psychiatric center. And we're down to like 1999. By the end of the 90s, I was burned out, you know, from hearing their stories, from seeing all the pain that they, you know, how families, you know, you get to the point where you're walking down the street and you're looking at people and thinking, well, is he molesting his daughter? Is she beating her son? Is she, you know, are there healthy families? And I knew I needed to get out of that field. So I was invited by friends to a religious retreat. They were in recovery. I bless God every day that I had the parents that I had the life and the discernment that I had. I never got into drugs, didn't smoke, didn't drink much. You know, I had my little party time in college, but I was very blessed not to get involved with substances. But I had friends who were in recovery, and they were going on this religious retreat. In fact, there's another one this April, and I've been invited. Come with us. This is what you need to come back and tell your story, because that retreat changed the total direction of my life. I
really? What
there
happened?
Burned, huh?
Well, what happened?
I'm sorry. Totally burned out, didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, didn't know where I wanted to work, what I wanted to do for a career, I didn't know who I was, where my life was going, nothing. And it was this retreat down in the Hudson Valley area, I think, and at a Jesuit retreat, I don't know, you know, it was like a monastery or something. And we couldn't talk during certain hours, that kind of stuff. But they had these great workshops. And I went into one. I heard stories that humbled me of these stories of addiction and what drew some of them to alcohol or drugs. I mean, these were stories I had heard before from teenagers and young people, but how, you know, really getting a firsthand testimonies of how those kind of childhoods that I had worked with, how it still impacted their adulthood that led them into drugs and alcohol. And so it was very humbling. So you kind of look at your life and say, okay, I've been through my stuff and I'm burned out, but I haven't been through anything like these women have been through. So that kind of put that in check for me. But the other thing, I walked into this one, I chose this one workshop called Job or Joy. And it talked about what was your joy? What were the things that brought you great joy? And every once in a while I had told stories at different events. It wasn't something, maybe I did twice a year or something. And I thought, man, when I tell stories, I feel the most alive. I just loved telling stories. I loved the experience of my father and mother telling stories. So I listened to that workshop and went through the workshop and the exercises and stuff with that thought in mind. Boy, I love it when that's when I'm feeling great joy. That's when I'm really tuned in to myself and the universe and everybody around me telling stories. And at the end of that workshop, I turned to my three friends and I said, within 3 years, I'm going to be a full-time storyteller. And one of my friends, Lucretia, this was like December of 1999, the end of the year. She came back to Syracuse, told everybody I was a storyteller, and referred me for different events. So by February, Black History Month, I had 17 gigs. Some of them were even paid.
You manifested that, didn't you? you absolutely created that reality for yourself.
Well,
that's
wonderful. Didn't even really. It was my friend. She spread the word. All of a sudden, I'm getting phone calls. I heard you're a storyteller. I didn't even have a repertoire. And so I was like quickly putting a repertoire together or looking at some of the stories my father had told or looking at the three or four stories I knew at the time. And one of the gigs was three Saturdays at the Onondaga Historical Association. And I pulled together some programs, one, you know, with African fables, one with slave stories. And so I pulled these stories together and did these three programs. And when I got my paycheck from them, there was a job description in the envelope. And I got offered with no interview. They said, you've already been through your interview. We see what you can do. Do you want the job? And it was for the director of education for the Onondaga Historical
Association.
Oh, wow.
And
it was great. Sorry, I didn't mean to step on you.
I got
to tell stories every day about the history of Syracuse, Onondaga County, upstate New York. And at the time, they were just beginning to put together an exhibit on the Underground Railroad, right up my alley, Black history. And I was a part of putting together an amazing exhibit that they have here. So it was just, you know, it was the right place, the right time. It was God's hand in my life saying, okay, you're burned out. You're trying to figure out what to do. Okay, I will take you to this retreat. I will take and I will give
you
the time to think.
Joy. You went for your joy. You put it out to the universe. You were going to be a storyteller. And a storyteller you became, and you became an educator, and I was privileged to hear you tell stories a year or so ago. And I'm wondering, I want to segue just for a moment, but I'm wondering if you would close the show with one of the stories that you told of the slaves, and you pick whatever one speaks to you. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you, we were talking before the show about the dark side and the light side, and you certainly witnessed a lot of the dark side coming at you in the form of prejudice and lack of tolerance, hatred, whatever motivated it. All of the different probably compounded sins of the fathers passed on to the sons from days gone by. How did you learn to separate from the darkness, and this may be a little bit redundant, whatever darkness it stirred up in you, to embrace the light and continue to hold your head up high in spite of, or in addition to the pride that you learned from your parents? Were there any other factors for you?
Oh, sure. There were teachers that you know appeared and that were there for me. I can remember Mr. Large, who I had the honor to talk to before he died, and tell him how much he meant to me, who saw the picking on and the bullying that went on, and who made in a school where there was no rule, you know, now they have the no put down rules and no bullying rules. It wasn't that at the school I went to, and who said in his classroom he wasn't going to allow it. You couldn't make fun, no making fun of people for all the things they did then. Braces. Now kids love braces, but braces, four eyes, you know, calling different different names that people called. It was through individuals like my friend, she's now Patty Shader, living out in California, where she kind of adopted me as a friend, she and another Patty, in fifth grade. I felt like this reverse Oreo cookie all the time. One would be on one side and one would be on the outside, and Vanessa the chocolate cream in the middle. And they were the most popular girls in our fifth grade class. And they would, you know, kids would make fun of me, and they would be like, we would never talk to you again. You talk to her like that. And everybody wanted to be their friends. So they used the power of their popularity to say, you're not going to make fun of her. I can think of a friend of mine who's a reverend now, Bob, who lives out in Minnesota. He was one of the most racist young men that I ever met in my life in sixth grade. And I remember he ended up liking one of my really good friends, Linda. And so we got to know each other, and Linda got him coming to church. This is when I had made the change to Fairmount Community Church. He and I became friends. We are friends to this day. He is a Facebook friend of mine. And he shifted, he changed, he made a choice, because he couldn't be with Linda as a friend, and he couldn't be with Linda's friends and be as racist as he was. And he is the most gentle, loving, person that you want to ever know. We used to write each other the first year in college. By seeing these kind of transitions in people, by leaving yourself open to love, where you don't condemn people because of their color, and I'm talking about me not condemning white people because of their color, because of what one white person had done or a group of white people have done to me, that I haven't condemned everyone. Some of the most richest friendships that I've had have come out of those situations. And not only people who were there for me and protected me, but those who were against me and became friends down the line because I was open to allowing them in. So I think it's a choice. It is a choice that if you follow the principles of God, if you say you believe, you're a Christian, you're a Jew, you're a Muslim, whatever you are, and you follow the tenets of that faith, not make them up, not listen to some guy who's uneducated and doesn't know what he's talking about and leads you down the wrong path. If you follow the tenets, if you truly believe that love is love, and then if you believe that you treat other people the way you want to be treated, then you get through things like this. Then you know who you are. I knew who I was as an African-American because my parents shored that up every day. And I knew who I was as a loving Christian human being because my parents shored that up every day. And I saw that reflected in a lot of the people around me. My Girl Scout leader, Mrs. Murphy, Mrs. Sill. I mean, I can name so many people that were white that countered for every negative message that I got from white people who were prejudiced. I got 20, 30, 50 messages from people who were white and were not. And so I think you have to choose not to be bitter. I think it's a choice. You have to choose, who do I want to be in this? What do I want my life to be like? Because the bottom line, it is about, all of it is about forgiveness. It is about forgiveness.
Yes.
It is about forgiveness,
yes, it is.
And forgiveness is not about the other person. Forgiveness is always about you, releasing yourself. So
I think that
has been the survival because, yeah, we talked about the dark, but see, the opposite of the dark is the light. For every dark situation, there is a possibility of light. And when you can find light in darkness, that is power. That is, we could sit under the sun all day, and we would never appreciate it if we didn't get the night. I'm not saying that you want the bad things to come. I'm not saying that we should have the bad things, but that is the balance of the world. That is the world, light and dark. And so
the
dark things are the very things that reflect back to me that the light bounces off of, and that creates a possibility of light in my life and shows the miracle you know, someone being a racist to someone being my best friend, that is the miracle every day.
Well, what
so
you've spoken
that's
of.
That's what I would say.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful. And we can run over because I don't want to cut you short. We have the capability of going past the hour mark. But what I wanted to say to you as you were sharing your life story, and please excuse me for trying to jump in at points, you're a compelling storyteller of your own life. What I heard in between the lines was that you attracted goodness, mostly the good. You talk about 20 to 30 times the good to the quote-unquote bad. And that, to me, speaks of the power of attraction. When we put out something positive, when we stand in our own truth, when we respect ourselves, behold ourselves as worthy children of God, beloved children of God, then nothing can hurt us. And we tend to attract more of the positive than the seeming negative. And I use the word seeming because I believe in the end it's all for the good. It's all part of the story of humanity. And we are raising consciousness on this planet. There's still a lot of problems going on, but times are changing. So much is changing, and thank God for that. And thank you for sharing your story today. Have you thought of a story that you would like to tell going back to slave times? Because I was so moved by the stories you told at the Historical Association.
Sure, I'd love to tell the story of Sarah Logan. Her father, the Reverend Jermaine Logan, founded the AME Zion Church in Syracuse along with Harriet Tubman. And Harriet Tubman used to use their house as a stop on the Underground Railroad, as well as other conductors on the Underground Railroad. Reverend Logan was a runaway slave himself, and his daughter Sarah wrote the stories of her childhood and life working on the Underground Railroad. And it's an unpublished document that's in the collection of Howard University. It was donated by her daughter who wrote her mother's stories down. So I want to tell, this is the story I want to tell.
Right.
Toot, 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 toot. That was the secret signal, three whistles from the train, one short, two long, two short, one long. The combination didn't matter. It was always three, and it always came at night. And it was my job as a little girl to grab blankets and give them to my mother and father. And Henry Kessel, this young teenage boy who came running away through our house and decided that he liked my mom and father and our family and that he was not going to go north to Canada. He was going to stay and live with us. We lived on the corner of Pine and East Genesee Street in Syracuse, New York. And we were a station on the Underground Railroad. Toot, toot, toot. That signal would come and everyone would stop whatever they were doing. And they would do their job, mine to get the blankets. And I would give them to my mother and father and Henry. And they would leave outside the side door of the house, sneak down Pine Street in the dark, down to what we call Railroad Street, really Washington Street, where the trains ran up and down all day and night through the black neighborhood on the east side of Syracuse. And my parents and Henry would turn right, turn towards the east, and walk down along the railroad tracks to a train tunnel, and they would wait there at its opening. Toot, toot, toot. The train would slow down in the tunnel, and off the train would jump runaway slaves, and they would fold into the arms of my parents and Henry, fold into those blankets that would keep them warm in the wintertime, fold into those blankets that would hide their faces year-round. As my parents and Henry snuck them back down the tracks and up the hill to Genesee Street to our house, sneak them back in that side door. Now, once inside, we would give them new clothing because they would be wearing the rags of slavery, sometimes in the winter leaving bloody footprints in the snow. Once inside, we would feed them because they'd be so hungry. And once inside, we would heal them if we could. One night, this young boy came. He had snagged his leg in the forest on the run, and it was swollen, and he was filled with infection and heat. He was feverish. And we took him up to a room down the hall from my room, and we tried to heal him, but there was no doctor in town. Dr. Clark was not in town, the only doctor we could trust not to turn these runaway slaves back in. See, because the law said what we were doing was illegal, helping property get to Canada. And so Starlight, this native woman, she rolled back out to her people, the Onondaga people, and she talked to the clan mothers, and they sent medicine. And we tried to use that medicine to save that boy, but when my mother left the room, when it was my time to sit with him and put cool cloths on his head, that boy died right in front of me. One time these six children came with three adults, and they all had bullet wounds in their arms, and I helped my mother take the bullet pellets out, helped her sew their skin back together from them running, from them being chased by bounty hunters. I bragged about it to my sister, but they said, I helped. I helped be a doctor. And they said, shut up, Sarah, after a while. We tired of hearing that story. See, we would put them in new clothes and feed them and heal them if we could. And then we would take them upstairs to a room with no windows, a fugitive slave's room, we called it. And there they would stay a night or two. His family stayed with us a whole month until it was safe to go to the next station on the Underground Railroad. And we would play with the children. But then they would tell us their stories of what it was like to be a slave, see their mothers beaten, their fathers sold away. And sometimes I just didn't want to hear no more stories about slavery. They'd stay with us a day or two or a week, this one family, a whole month, and then they would leave to the next station on the Underground Railroad. Now, my mother, she sat us down when we were old enough to understand, and she told us, she would tell us, she would say, now, you can talk about me and my family, because, see, my mother was born in upstate New York, a free black woman. But don't you talk about your daddy at all. See, don't you say nothing about him. If anybody asks you anything, a stranger approaches you, you remember what he looked like, the direction he left and what he said exactly, and you come and you tell me. You see, because my father, the Reverend Jermaine Logan, my father who founded the AME Zion Church, my father was a runaway slave. And if bounty hunters found him, he would be returned to the South to his master. And we would never, ever see him again. And so we all learned in that house how to keep the secret of what was going on there as conductors, as a station on the Underground Railroad. The story of Sarah Logan and her family. Sarah Logan went on to become a doctor, graduating amongst some of the first black women doctors in the country. She went to Syracuse University's medical school. So there is
amazing. A
story from that time.
Thank you, Vanessa. That's a wonderful story. I remember you telling that. Well, I am very blessed to have you here with us tonight, and thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a nice conversation.
Yes, it was. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.